This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 9th of December 2010, and I am talking once again to our frequent guest, but it's been a long time since we've had him on the program, Dr. Tim Ball, who was a renowned environmental consultant and former climatology professor at the University of Winnipeg. He also employs his extensive background in climatology and other fields as an advisor to the International Climate Science Coalition, the Friends of Science, and the Frontier Center for Public Policy, and he is a frequent contributor to CanadaFreePress.com. Dr. Ball, it's always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much for coming back on the program.
Well, thanks for the opportunity and appreciate the work you're doing.
Well, thank you for that. And I guess probably listeners might well remember that the last time that we talked was about 1 year ago, when just as the ClimateGate emails was breaking, and I believe we talked really just a couple of days after the emails were first released, and that was one of the first viral videos related to ClimateGate, so we had an effect getting the word out about that very important event, and as we've both seen over the course of the last year, the effect of that, just the ramifications of that event just continue to echo out, and really we've seen a complete shift in the entire frame of reference over the anthropogenic climate disruption, alarmism scare, or whatever the PC term is these days. So perhaps we could just take a moment to step back and think about how things have changed over the course of the past year.
Well, yes, the anniversary of ClimateGate. The interesting thing about ClimateGate, it's like with Watergate. It wasn't just the event. And people that looked at the emails didn't understand the climate science, but they did understand the malfeasance and corruption and getting editors fired and those sorts of things. So it had an impact. But the bigger issue since really has been, as with Watergate, the cover-up and the whitewash by the committees that were appointed to investigate were so patently fixed that it just reinforced. I think if they hadn't tried to do the cover-up, a lot of the public would still not realize the implications of what they were saying, because you needed to understand the climate science to know exactly what they were saying and what they were doing. For example, phrases like the trick and hide the decline really need there's a hint of something wrong with them, but they try to brush them off by saying, oh no, this is just in a different context and you don't understand and so on. But as I say, the cover-up has really done things in, and it really has turned the whole chain pattern. But you know what's interesting is that the most significant thing has been the cold weather. And I think if you take that out of the equation, and of course they're trying to offset the cold by falsifying the data to claim that 2010 was going to be the warmest year on record, and the giveaway on that is that they started saying it 2 months before the year was even over. But the cold weather has done more in many ways than the exposure of ClimateGate, although ClimateGate, for the people that know what's going on, and the cover-up of it was very, very significant.
Absolutely no question of that. And it seems like they're trying to have their cake and eat it three ways, because not only do they say that weather is not climate, they then go on to trumpet the hottest year on record every single year. And then they also say, well, it doesn't matter if it's cooling, because that's also a product of man-made global warming. So basically, they're just trying to have it any possible way that the weather
is
going.
And you refer to that in your introduction, because, of course, as I think we might have discussed, you always watch when they keep moving the goalposts that something's wrong. So they went from global warming to climate change, and then you mentioned climate disruptions, which, of course, is the phrase that the Obama White House and their science czar, John Holdren, has given to it. And it's all part of the attempt to continue to push the carbon footprint, the CO2, and all of the political use of that, and then, of course, the economic ramifications of it.
And I never miss an opportunity to point out John Holdren's checkered past and his 1977 co-authored book, Eco Science, in which he advocated such things as forced sterilization agents put into the water supply and other such ghastly, unthinkable ideas in the name of saving the world from the overpopulation problem, which he thought was going to ravage the world by the year 2000. So that's the type of people who are often behind this type of scientific travesty that we continue to see unfolding, unfortunately. And I think you're right, the cover-up did wake up a lot of people to what was really going on and what was really wrong with ClimateGate, but of course it only reinforced the almost religious fervor of those who have that kind of true believer attitude to what's going on. So I think what it really boils down to, as you said, is the vast majority of people are moving on from this story, and the mainstream media, as you point out in your latest CanadaFreePress.com article, aren't. So let's get into Cancun and what's going on right now.
Well, Cancun, of course, is the continuation of the Conference of the Parties, which is abbreviated to COP. COP 1 was in Berlin, and now we're at Cancun is COP 16. So you can see we've had 16 years, consecutive years of this. They're also planning another one in Durban, South Africa, for next year. And these are, and of course, the cost, both in terms of, you know, if they're claiming CO2 is a problem, the amount of CO2 they're putting out to get to these various places, and the cost to the taxpayer of these things. But what they're doing, and it's interesting because Cancun was a very significant shift in that some of the participants, for example, a German professor, and I should apologize, I don't got his name at my fingertips, but he was a member of the Working Group 3 of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He came out and said, look, this never was about the science, it's about wealth distribution. And of course, that's what Kyoto was all about. And what they're trying to do at COP 16, as they've done from COP 1 all the way through, is to get the Kyoto Accord through. And they're not going to succeed this time either. They didn't at Copenhagen, I suspect, primarily because of the leaks of the emails. And I think that the emails were leaked to undermine Copenhagen, and it did it very, very effectively. And the story of how the leak went on is it supports that. But they're trying to push Kyoto. Ironically, Japan has come out and said they're not going to continue with the Kyoto Accord, also Russia, the U.S., and Canada have also said Kyoto, as it's structured, is dead, but they are still all talking about reducing CO2. Now, what's happened at Cancun is, of course, so we're seeing the death knell. And by the way, it is wonderful that they had record cold temperatures during the conference. It's almost like every time Al Gore goes anywhere, it snows. I think it's Mother Nature saying, you know, it's not nice to fool with me. But what they're trying to do at Cancun is to continue Kyoto, or at least reconstitute it. And of course, none of it is necessary because it's all focused on CO2, and CO2 is not a problem. Now, just to back up a little bit, the original idea of Kyoto came out of the political side of Maurice Strong's setting up of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, which was designed to prove that CO2 from humans was causing runaway global warming. The Rio conference was taking it into the political arena. And Strong, of course, also organized and chaired that. And at that meeting, of course, which, by the way, the elder Bush refused to attend because he saw it as a political machination. But at the Rio conference, the concept of carbon credits and Kyoto were put in place. It wasn't until the third COP at Kyoto that the actual agreement was set out. And, of course, what it did was it divided the world up into developed and developing nations. And the developed nations were going to be punished for the sin of producing too much CO2 and in doing that, advancing their economies. at the expense of the climate, the resources, and the developing world. So they were going to be charged a tax on carbon, which was then going to be paid to the developing nations in this great wealth equalization situation. And of course it became a farce right away, because you could buy carbon credits and therefore continue your burning and producing of fossil fuels as long as you paid the money over to the developing nations. It's a parallel with it, by the way, are the indulgences that the church set up in the Middle Ages, where you could sin, but you could buy your way into heaven. It's the same concept. Well, the Kyoto Accord simply has failed. And it's interesting to look at its history in that it came very close to not being ratified, because it needed a certain number of nations to sign on, and they were one short. And that one nation, the U.S., of course, refused. They voted 95-0 against it, even with Al Gore as vice president. But the one nation that was a holdout was Russia. And so it was very important that they get Russia to sign on, otherwise, under the draft of the treaty, it simply died. It was almost like a bill in Parliament simply didn't get enough votes, so it died on the order table. And Russia was going to sign. And in fact, Putin's economic advisor, Ilarionov, was wandering around the world giving very, very good, scientifically accurate PowerPoints of what was wrong with the science. And then all of a sudden, Putin signs, and Ilarionov resigned, and it turned out that the reason that Putin signed was because those nations that were pushing Kyoto said, look, if you don't sign, by the way, mostly Europeans, they said, if you don't sign, we will not support your application to the World Trade Organization. And Putin decided that that was a bigger prize than holding out on the nonsense, the scientific nonsense that was Kyoto. And of course, Russia did what many other countries did, including Japan, by the way, in that they signed, but they didn't ratify. So they said, oh yeah, we've signed, aren't we the good guys? But then they had no intention of ratifying or putting in place anything to do with it. And one of the things a lot of people don't know is that a nation could agree to or ratify Kyoto, but unless they passed an internal law. So each nation had to pass a law implementing Kyoto. They didn't have to do anything about it. And this is why in some countries like Canada, those that were in favor of Kyoto were fighting so hard to get an internal law passed. And so all of these machinations speak to what's going on at Cancun, the continuation of it. And of course, what you're seeing at Cancun is a very clear division. The scientists that are there are political scientists. They're people with a political agenda. Even though they're scientists, and of course, they're willing to continue to believe that the science and push that the science is correct, even though it's so patently obvious it isn't. And then the majority of the people at Cancun are bureaucrats. And that's where the real threat is, James, that the IPCC was set up by Maurice Strong through the World Meteorological Organization. And he did it that way because he knew that if he could get these bureaucrats within each government on board, and the chair, for example, of the initial meeting at which they drafted the plans for IPCC in 1985 was chaired by the Assistant Deputy Minister for Environment Canada. And these people then became the standard bearers through the bureaucracy, because Strong has a total derision for politicians. I mean, when he spoke to Elaine Dewar, about his plans to bring down the industrialized nation. She said, well, if you got that idea, why don't you run for politics? And he said, oh, no, you can't do anything as a politician. I'm going to go to the UN where I can get all the money I want and not be accountable to anybody. Well, by setting this thing up through the World Meteorological Organization meant then that it's within the bureaucracies that the real corruption is occurring, and of course aided and abetted by the scientists like the ones at the East Anglia, the Climatic Research Unit. And it's within the bureaucracies that the data, the temperature data has been manipulated. To the point where in New Zealand, a group called the Climate Science Group brought a lawsuit against the agency that was manipulating the data for New Zealand. And what they were doing was lowering the old temperature to make the slope or increase of temperature look much greater than it actually was. And what happened was they didn't go to court. The government agency just backed off and said, okay, you know, you're right, and we won't do it anymore. And now what you're seeing is the UK Met Office, under pressure from some politicians, is also reviewing all of its data. And of course, they worked with the University of East Anglia, and it was Cook there, and also NOAA. And the outlier on this still another government agency is NASA GIS, whose director James Hansen has been openly political throughout. So these are some of the ramifications of Cancun and what's going on there. But basically, the idea in the public's mind is dead.
Thankfully so, and it couldn't have come at a better time, I think, just as they were about to close the deal last year in Copenhagen, and luckily that was averted. But I think what we're looking at here is sort of a Russian doll of frauds inside of frauds inside of frauds, and it's almost difficult to find your way through them all. But I guess there is a scientific fraud, which we've seen in such things as they hide the decline and hiding the medieval warming period and trying to reverse the correlation between temperature and CO2 and other such scientific frauds. But underlying that, of course, is the political motivation for the fraud. And we have, as you pointed out, there was the German scientist Otmar Edenhofer, the IPCC official, who recently came out to say, quote, "One must say clearly that we redistribute de facto the world's wealth by climate policy," end quote. But underlying that fraud is the fact that came out last year in the Danish text at Copenhagen that showed that, in fact, the entire scheme is not even going to benefit the developing world. In fact, they were going to be hit with up to twice as much carbon taxes and punitive measures as the developed world under this secret agreement that was being worked on at the conference. So it's just so many layers of fraud. And of course, everyone is trying to do these political machinations to come out on top of the fraud game. And of course, we have people like Maurice Strong who are puppeteering it from the top. So it is just a horrific situation. And it's kind of strange that it's actually lasted as long as it has. It's usually these types of things just collapse under their own weight.
Yeah, well, I think that's the amazing part is the level of the deception and the fact that they were able to do it on a global basis. And of course, that tends to put it into Hitler's big lie, that the bigger the lie, the more people will believe it. And it's certainly, as you unfold these layers, and of course for me, I watched my discipline hijacked, and I knew what they were doing at East Anglia, and I knew what was going on at Environment Canada, where they were diverting money, public funding, away from the job they were supposed to be doing into computer models that were going to show that CO2 was the problem, and knowing full well those computers were simply not capable of it. And of course, this is one of the things that, to add on to why the government agencies are so responsible, because in most countries, they controlled the funding that went to climate science, and they only funded that science that supported one side of the issue. Anybody that wanted to do research that questioned that science just simply didn't get funded. And so you had a situation where 99% of the money, the funding money, was going to one side, and that meant, of course, that only those articles were getting published, which then allowed them in a vicious circular argument to say, well, look, all of the peer-reviewed publications are on one side. There's no publications on the other side, which proves that that must be right. And so this is all part of the game. The other thing, James, I think that's important to understand is that they have exploited fear, and Michael Crichton, of course, nailed that down with his wonderful book, State of Fear, which was actually three books within one. It was a novel, but it was also a scientifically accurate. And just as a matter of interest to you and your listeners, Crichton shared a room at Harvard with Richard Lindzen. And of course, Richard Lindzen is one of the preeminent so-called skeptics throughout all of this situation.
Very interesting. And I should just point out for listeners, I just interviewed Dr. Lindzen a couple of weeks ago, so they can check that out in my archives.
Well, that's the connection, and of course, so that's why the science in Crichton's book is so good. But yeah, they exploited fear, but they also exploited not only the lack of understanding of climate science, but the lack of understanding of science in general amongst most of the public. Now, I taught a science credit for art students. It was part of a liberal arts education plan, and I discovered that that generally 80% of students would avoid lab courses, and that's a synonym for science courses, and 20% were reasonably comfortable in science courses, and I suggest that that's about the same division amongst the general public. So you've got 80% of the people who not only don't understand science, but will almost brag about, those nerdy number guys. We don't, we're not one of those. And numbers are they're proud of not knowing numbers. And so it was very easy. And of course, again, when you look at the thing going through the bureaucracy, let's say you're a politician and you don't agree with what's going on, and you go to your government agency scientists and say, hey, I got some problems with this, and they're going to come back and say, oh, well, we're scientists, we're experts in this, you're just a politician, how dare you question us? So all of these things then work towards, and of course they were part of Maurice Strong's thinking. And the one thing you've got to hand to Maurice Strong is the guy is incredibly manipulative and clever in what he set up. And I've talked to people, everything from people that were literally in elementary school with him and right through high school, or he didn't go far in high school, he quit at 15, but and then people that have worked with him or worked for him. Every one of them had nothing nice to say about the man, but every one of them also said he was incredibly manipulative and clever. And of course, he conned so many of the world leaders, particularly through people like Paul Martin, the Canadian Prime Minister, and of course, then he's also worked with George Soros, who's put up a lot of the funding. So it was. In Canada, for example, just to illustrate the funding issue, all science funding is done through the National Science Foundation, which was set up as an arm's length from government to keep politics out of the science funding. But all climate research funding went through Environment Canada, the bureaucracy, in a complete overthrow of how it's supposed to be done within the country, yet nobody picked up on that. And of course, as I said earlier, they were funding only those people that agreed with them. And in fact, a few years ago, when our then Minister of Environment, David Anderson, came out and said, all Canadian scientists agree with Kyoto, and that's why we're signing it. Well, eight of us went to Ottawa and stood up at a press conference and said, hey, here's eight climate scientists that were not consulted and don't agree. And what the government did was, in order to draw the media away from us, they suddenly announced that they were going to have a debate in the House that day to sign Kyoto. Well, of course, that drew all of the media away from us in a deliberate move to divert attention. So, as I say, this what he's done is absolutely incredible. And of course, the other part of it, James, is that old saying about no one person can change the world. Well, I'm afraid it's not true. The problem is that when you get one person changing the world, it's almost always to the negative and the bad.
Unfortunately, very true, and something that we've touched on in our previous conversations. So just wrapping up the Cancun portion of this conversation, in 100 words or less, what would you say is your prognostication for the outcome of COP16?
Well, I think that the pressure to keep the CO2 thing going, it's very high. Because of course there are people that made political careers on it, but there's also academics that have made academic careers on it. But more importantly, the huge amounts, and I'm talking into the hundreds of millions of dollars of funding going to the research and into corporations that have been set up around tax breaks on alternate energies and all of these other things. And so you built up such a huge part of the economy around the alternate energy and the so-called green jobs and so on, that it's going to take some time, because there will be considerable resistance, even though people will say, well, yeah, okay, so the science is all phony, so what? We're making money off of this, and that's what's important. So I think that it will gradually die, but it's going to take some time. And then, of course, what we've got to do is put in place alternate policies to deal with the lack of energy that's required, that's going to be needed.
Absolutely. Well, that would be sensible scientific progress instead of what we've been used to for the last 20 years. But at any rate, what really brought us together tonight was a new book that has just been released, which you are a contributor to. It's called Slaying the Sky Dragon, Death of the Greenhouse Gas Theory. Perhaps you can tell us a little bit about this book, what it contains, and how you got involved with this project.
Okay. I've been working on a book on my own, but I'm still working on it, and it's a slightly different direction than this book. But this came about, and I sort of became the lead author because I set the context for the other chapters in the book. And that helps people understand, just the structure of the book helps people understand how this deception has been achieved. Climatology is a generalist discipline, and I explain that in the introduction to the book, and yet we're in an age of specialization. And, of course, trying to bring all the pieces together that cause weather and climate change requires somebody that has a very, very wide range of reading and understanding. And what happened was that in the corruption of the climate science, they started using information from specialist areas. A good analogy of this, by the way, it infects every part of society, this generalist against specialist contradiction. The analogy I like to use is that the patient's lying on the table and the podiatrist is looking at the feet and the nephrologist at the kidneys and the neurologist at the brain, and the nurse is in the corner saying, but doctors, the patient is dead. And so we've got this problem that the amount of knowledge and amount of information has become so vast that it's broken down into individual pieces. And if anybody knows anything about psychology, it's sort of the gestaltist thing, that the sum of the parts are greater than the whole. Well, that's very true of this situation. And but in the corruption, they misused the specialist pieces from other areas. And this was one of the things that triggered the first breakthrough, even before Climategate, and that was the hockey stick. Now, Stephen McIntyre, who identified the hockey stick, which was a graph that looked like a hockey stick was showing temperatures steady for 1,000 years and then a sudden upturn in the blade of the 20th century. He was at a conference nothing to do with climate. And somebody put this graph up and happened to be talking about it. And McIntyre immediately knew from his specialist training as a statistician and a grapher of statistical information how they'd achieve that graph. So he then went and said, well, I'm going to go and look at the climate and what's going on here. And of course discovered how they literally cooked the data, and what they'd done with the hockey stick was literally rewrite history and the historic record. And so what you had then was a specialist suddenly seeing one small part of the whole climate argument and debate and realizing that there was something wrong with that one little bit. But of course McIntyre didn't realize that there were most other areas that the same things had happened. I knew that because that's what I'd been doing all of my career. And so what we've tried to do in the book is for me to explain this generalist specialist situation, and then we have each chapter is written by a specialist looking at one part of the whole climate argument, and the IPCC reports say, no, this is how they've misused the science of my specialist area. Just one quick little example. In terms of how the Earth's atmosphere is heated, they argued that the sun comes in, heats the ground, the heat from the ground goes out, and then there is, the term was back radiation, that is that it hits the greenhouse gases and then reflects back to warm the Earth. Well, that's completely against two of the fundamental laws of physics. And so in his chapter, the specialist explains that. And even though he tries to do it in a way that the more of the public can understand it, still, a lot of people will get lost with it, and of course, that's how they've been able to fool people. And another example is that in the computer models, they assume that the Earth is a flat disk, and they assume that the energy from the sun strikes that flat disk evenly over the whole disk. Well, I mean, this is absolute nonsense. Everybody knows.
They literally believe the world is flat.
Exactly. And by the way, I'm in favor of a flat Earth, because when we had a flat Earth, you could push the idiots off the edge. Now they come right back around at you. But yeah, they literally were dealing with a flat Earth. And of course, one of the reasons is that the minute you start dealing with a spherical Earth, you're into a whole complexity of geometry called topology, a three-dimensional geometry that the computer models simply couldn't handle. And the computer capacity wasn't there for it. And of course, then, as I pointed out to the author of that chapter when I reviewed it for him, that not only is it not flat, but it's spherical and it's spinning. And so you add the rotation into it, and it gets even more complicated. And so these are the kinds of things that we have tried to do with each chapter. Say, okay, here's one little piece, and it shows you how they deliberately misused the science of it in order to support this larger picture of the generalist climate view. And of course, one of the ways they played this game, James, was people didn't even know the difference between weather and climate, and still most people don't know. And weather is what you experience at any given instance when you're standing out in the atmosphere. It's made up of, it's the sum total of everything from cosmic radiation in deep space to heat coming out of the Earth through the crust of the Earth and particularly into the oceans, and everything in between. So it's what scientists call a white noise, but it's made up of millions of pieces of red noise, individual noises, and that's the weather. The climate is the average of that weather over time. And it's the average of how it changes over time and how it varies regionally. So they then tried to argue just to show you how they were able to fool people, as I used to do, get up to an audience and try to get them to understand, say, look, these people can't even tell you the weather 10 days from now, but they're so certain about 100 years from now. How does that work? And, of course, they came back through the climatic research unit, Gavin Schmidt in particular, where he said, the short-term forecast is the weather, the long-term is the climate, and they're different things. Well, no. The climate is made up of the weather, and if you can't get the weather right, you certainly can't get the climate right. But this is just another illustration of the deceptions and the fraud, and of course that's what we've tried to do in the book, is provide the context for how they were able to deceive using the science, and by the way, even deceive an awful lot of the science community. So that gives you an idea of what the book is about.
Right. It's like saying, I can't tell you who's going to win the baseball game tomorrow, but I can tell you who's going to win the pennant 15 years from now. It's quite a bold, bold prediction.
Yeah.
Well, exactly. And it looks like a fascinating book. Tell us about some of the authors who are included in here.
Well, as I said, they're specialists in their particular areas. Hans Schroeder is one of them. But by the way, I don't know the specific abilities of each of them. All I know is that we've covered these various things like the physics of the atmosphere, the radiation energy from the sun, and so on. And the reason I don't know is because I haven't been coordinating the book. I just wrote my section, and then I reviewed a couple of the chapters. So I apologize for that. But there is one thing that's come out of this. The chapter that I was talking to you about the radiative energy, the actual greenhouse gases, is a professor from Sweden by the name of Claes Johnson. And he was lecturing on his view of this in the university, and they fired him. And the battle continues, and it really is frightening, the degree of intimidation that's gone on. And but as I said, the chapters, there's one on each of the main components. Obviously, we can't do them all. There's nothing on the hockey stick graph, for example, because that's already out there. But it is discussed in general terms. But each of the major scientific frauds within their whole body of work is what we've tried to focus on.
Excellent. Well, again, that is Slaying the Sky Dragon, Death of the Greenhouse Gas Theory, and it is available from online booksellers like Amazon, and as I understand, it's already number 8 on the Amazon bestseller list and number 1 in the science list after having been out for a grand total of three days or 4 days of publication. So just incredible sales, and it just goes to show, as you said before, that the people are waking up to the fraud.
Well, they're waking up to the fraud, and of course, the other reason that we did the book the way we did it was that my opening lines are almost, how were they able to deceive the whole world? That's the question that people are starting to ask now and say, okay, the cold weather has raised questions. And by the way, there were a couple of things. One, of course, Al Gore's statement that the science is settled. Even the mainstream media picked up on that and said, hang on a minute, science has never settled. And the other one was, of course, that when the cold weather came and they started arguing, oh, no, the cold is proof of warming. And I think you mentioned that in your intro. And that was another comment that raised people's eyebrows. Now, of course, then what we're trying to answer with the book is, well, how did they achieve this deception? And so we're explaining it from the scientific point of view, and in my section also the political machinations of Maurice Strong through the IPCC, using that for the science, and then, as I mentioned earlier, using the Rio conference from the political end. The next issue, of course, that's going to be raised, and we refer to this briefly in the book, is what was the motive? Why were they doing this? And of course, that's going to become the next big question in the public's mind. And as I said, we do touch on that briefly. And of course, it's around the idea of the Club of Rome, of the overpopulation, which is, of course, why John Holdren is in the White House as the science czar, because Morris Strong, also a member of the Club of Rome, and Paul Ehrlich, who with the complete failure of all of their predictions, they should have no credibility left at all, yet they do. They're on all sorts of international committees and boards, these people, as are the former terrorists, ones, some of them in the White House, and Van Jones and these people. The motive is that you wanted to be able to bring down the industrialized nations because they were the cause of overpopulation, and the overpopulation and the rate at which that overpopulation was using up the resources was destroying the planet. And of course, that's the original theme of the Club of Rome, that there are too many people and they're using too many resources because of the development of industry and industrialization, and therefore it ultimately the planet's going to collapse. And so this is the theme behind all of this. And these people have worked at this for 30 years, but it wasn't until Morris Strong came along and was able to put it into practice through the United Nations. And of course, the other part of it is that they argue that the only way to stop this is not only shut down the industry and the developed nations that are the evil people, but also then to have one world government, that these people would then, through the United Nations, control every nation in the world and tell everybody how to live and what to do and so on. And this is really what's going on behind the whole thing. And as I say, we touch on that briefly in the book, but it's not a major part of the book, but it's got to be, and I'm working on a book on that I hope to get out shortly, that will develop these ideas of the motive behind it.
Well, I would, for one, would be extremely interested to read that book, because that is exactly why I do cover this topic so tenaciously, because if it was just a question of a scientific fraud, it would still be important, but perhaps not so important to the average layman. But what this fraud represents is just a staggering and potentially horrific move toward world government and people who are advocating the same old eugenics type failed science quackery that we've seen, unfortunately, for generations, but it has just been around in one form or another, and the intellectual progeny of Thomas Malthus, unfortunately, still infest the upper reaches of power. So it is a very... Yes, go ahead.
It's very frightening, but just to add one point to it, and of course, to undermine and show how wrong they are in their thinking, in the last 50 years or so, the population issue, of course, has been bubbling. And in fact, when you talk to people, I mean, I had one fellow, unfortunately, just passed away, Charlie Keenan, and he agreed with everything I was saying about the science, but he would always come around and say, "Well, you know, you're right, Tim, but." I still think overpopulation is a problem. Well, if you're going to solve the population problem, and by the way, the level of Malthusian thought occurred in 1976, based upon Ehrlich and Holdren's predictions. They had a conference in Rome because they said the world's going to be starving to death by the year 2000, and they had a conference in Rome about feeding the world. And of course, now we've got the situation where you got obesity is a problem in those developed nations, not lack of food. There's still the problem of failure to be able to store food efficiently and proper distribution networks. But here's the ironic thing that's developed during the last 50 years. There's something called the demographic transition, and you can actually Google it under those two words. And this is the idea that was first seen in Sweden amongst that population, and it actually applies to all the developed world. As the economy improves and people become more secure in their future and their ability to make money and to retire, then the birth rate drops. Because one of the reasons that people had so many children in the old days was because such a high percentage of them died. And if you didn't have enough children to survive, the children became your pension plan. They were going to look after you in old age. And of course, once you eliminated the number of children dying, the drop in the death rate amongst children, then you didn't have the problem, and so the birth rate drops. Well, of course, then what also happens is people are living longer. So the death rate declines, and what you get then is initially a very significant increase in population, but then it levels off. And so you can see that in those nations that developed and had good, strong economies and could set up things like social programs and pension plans and so on, the population stabilized and, in fact, in many countries is declining. And in those developed nations where it's declining, they've offset the decline in population with immigration. And so it masks what's actually happening. But in those countries, such as Japan, where you are, they didn't allow the immigration. They've got what's called the population pyramid, the natural pattern of a lot of young people with a pyramid to a peak of very few older people. That's now inverting, so that you've got a much smaller base, the pyramid's upside down, and an increasingly large and expensive older generation. And in countries like Italy, just to put it in numbers, in order to maintain your population, you need between 2.4 and 2.6 children per family. Well, in countries like Italy or other areas, it's down to 1.4 children per family. And so you've got this decline, and Italy for quite some time now has been offering a large amount of money to a family that would have a third child. And the same is true of various countries throughout the world, that if they can't offset with immigration, then they're offering incentives, financial and other incentives, to have more children. So the ironic thing about the Club of Rome is that if you really wanted to deal with overpopulation, what you would do is allow development and allow industry, because you'd achieve your goal very efficiently. In fact, almost too efficiently. So it's very interesting. The damage that these people have done is not only have they not are not able to achieve what they want to achieve, but they've suppressed what they could achieve, and also, of course, they've suppressed progress in more efficient use of energies and fuels and so on, with money going into alternate energies which simply don't work. And if you take the subsidies out of all the alternate energies, that they simply collapse overnight. And by the way, that is pending this coming year. There's a lot of countries where they've withdrawn subsidies for alternate energies. That's going to be a shock too.
Absolutely right. Absolutely. Everything you said there is spot on. So from your own perspective, tell us what time frame we're looking at for this forthcoming book.
Well, I hope to, as I said, I hope to have it out within a couple of months. It's about three quarters finished. And of course, now with electronic publishing, it's so much quicker and easier to do it. And I've got people looking at some of the chapters now for an internal peer review. So, as I said, hopefully within a couple of months, I'll have it out. Because I think that the next questions are going to be, you know, what was the motive, and how was it, we've seen how they corrupted the science by altering the data and using the computer models falsely, but then the question becomes the political machinations of it all. And then, of course, what the fallout is going to be. And hopefully, we're going to look back and say that ClimateGate occurred just in time before the world descended into total loss of control to a very small elite and group, and that's what history will show. But yeah, I hope to have it out within a couple of months.
All right. Well, as I say, I'm definitely looking forward to that, and I hope as soon as that is available that you'll let me know, and we can have you on again to talk about that.
Oh, absolutely, James, because even in those dark days, you were one of the few people that were willing to hear all sides of a story before you made up your mind. And one of the things that I desperately try to do is say, look, I don't care if you believe me, but at least listen to me. And if you then choose not to listen, that's your choice. But people kept saying to me, well, why do you keep pushing away, even though you're being shown to be wrong or you're in the minority? And my answer kept being, I don't want anybody, especially politicians, to be able to come back later and say, I wasn't told. And the answer is, you were told. You chose not to listen, and therefore you've got to be held accountable. But holding people accountable these days is another whole issue that needs to be discussed.
It certainly is. Well, as a former believer in the global warming myth myself, I must thank you the tireless efforts of yourself and others who have been bringing this issue to the fore for so many years and continuing to do so in the face of so much overwhelming opposition and just ridiculous smear attempts on yourself. So I'd like to thank you for continuing to persist until it seems like we're finally starting to turn the tide.
Well, thank you, James. Yeah, and of course, as anybody that ultimately is vindicated, you find out that there's no pleasure in I told you so. There's absolutely no pleasure, because all you can think about is those people whose careers and lives were damaged by what these people have done. I mean, just one quick example, and this is also what needs to be done, is an assessment of the damage. The biofuels issue, where they were turning corn into fuel, so rich Americans could drive vehicles, and it pushed corn prices through the roof, so people were starving in Africa. And so it's not just the direct damage, but the collateral damage of what these people have done is really very needs to be assessed, and it's really disturbing.
And if I'm correct, Al Gore recently came out to say that that was a huge mistake.
Well, he's made some sort of statements along that line. The biofuels one, yes, but of course, the corruption of an Al Gore, and by the way, he is representative of a new breed. He has never had a job. All he's ever done is in politics. And it's interesting to look at Britain, where all of the top politicians in Britain now are professional politicians. They've never held jobs outside of politics. And that's a very bad trend. But yeah, I mean, Gore is trying to salvage his own image rather than really admit what he did was totally corrupt and also probably criminal, because for example, when you tell people that CO2 is destroying the earth, and do it in a movie and go around the world promoting that, then turn around and make money off of that by selling carbon credits, that is by definition in the U.S. fraud. So the man is certainly a criminal, but he's trying to salvage now his legacy. But whether he'll ever come out and admit that the whole thing was wrong, I doubt it, because it takes a... one thing I've learned in my life, it takes a very strong person to admit they're weak. And I don't think Gore is that strong.
Probably correct, but we can always hope. Well, at any rate, we'll have to leave it there. Another fascinating conversation. So thank you again. And I'd like to direct listeners again to buy Slaying the Sky Dragon from Amazon, or to go to CanadaFreePress.com for more of your commentary. Is there anywhere else you'd like to direct listeners to tonight?
Well, no, I think that those are fine. The main outlet, I do two articles a week in Canada Free Press, and I've got going back to 2007, so there's a lot of back articles on there. They can get through the columnist archives. And so much of what we've been discussing here was itemized even before ClimateGate, so it'll help people understand that there were some of us that knew what was going on. But I really appreciate what you've done. Thank you, James.
Well, thank you.